right. This is the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. I am Scott May, and we have Dan Carey back here with us. Sorry if I sound a little sped up today. A goal I had personally been working for a long time just got announced today. I'm going to have my first novel come out in like a year or so. While that is not relevant to this podcast, it's certainly going to show up in my voice. So I figured I would warn you guys on that. How are you doing?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Dan. How are you doing today?
Doing all right. Busy day, but I'm doing all right.
Yeah, I'm guessing around this time of the year you have a lot of busy days. Today, the topic I think I wanted to talk to you most revolves around your sort of legacy of innovation in brewing. And, you know, you're a brewmaster who's won the Carl Strauss Award specifically for innovation in brewing and are certainly operating at the top of your game. And when I think of artists and crafts people, once you reach a certain point, you know, you know how to follow all of the rules in brewing. You essentially reach a point where you kind of want to start breaking them, right? And you want to start marrying styles. You want to start sort of leaving your own mark on that. So can you tell us a little bit about how you first started doing that, or when that pull to start innovating yourself sort of grew within you?
Well, I guess, first of all, brewers are consider themselves to be scientific in nature, follow a scientific method. But the dirty little secret about science is science is just simply another religion in a lot of ways. That there's a lot of dogma in brewing. And so brewers have guardrails that are dictated by the religion, by the dogma. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I'm usually indignant and shocked when I find out that the emperor is not wearing clothes, that sometimes what is accepted to be the truth is not always actually the truth. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always skeptical of how things should be done. And I love various types of beers, but I don't think in terms of styles. I don't think that the old European brewers thought in terms of style. Okay, in Germany now there are laws on the strength of how beer should be brewed, and brews are very uniformly designed to be a certain way. But if you go to a place like Belgium, it's pretty much a free-for-all. And I think that speaks more to how beer used to be, say, before the Industrial Revolution, before the 1800s, when lager brewing was really put into stone on how lager beer is to be brewed. But traditionally, beer is an innovative process. So I like to take the best of different types of beers to come up with something. And I don't try to copy other people's beers because they already exist. And when you copy, you're always going to be an also-ran. So try to think about my own twist on a given beer. And styles, I don't really think about it in that way. I think about a taste. How do I want a beer to taste?
Well, that makes just an absolute lot of sense. And I think there's a number of touchstone beers that you've made that I think fans of yours and this brewery would certainly recognize that I think are, you know, for the time they were brewed and what they have accomplished, I think were particularly innovative. You know, certainly Spotted Cow, when you were first brewing that, I always think of that me and Randy got into this a little bit last week. You know, once you have something that becomes sort of that successful, it's easy to lose track of how different it was when it first came out. Now, when you were first thinking about brewing a beer like Spotted Cow that sort of marries a couple of different traditions together, what was that process like for you?
Well, I've told the story many times in interviews, but Spotted Cow was one of 200 different beers or more that we've brewed over the 30-year life of our company. We make lots of beers, and there was it was not loved nor imagined to be anything special more than the other 200 beers. It was just one of many beers, and with no expectations, but people gravitated towards it. So we, when that row in the warehouse went empty, we made more, and it just caught on with people's people just liked it. But the idea for that beer simply came from a visit to an open air museum in Old World, Wisconsin, in Eagle, Wisconsin. So what that means is there was homesteads that they had, this group had gone around the state and purchased homesteads of different cultures and moved them to this plot of land. So you walk around this multiple acre site and you visit these homesteads, farms. And they represented, and people would be dressed up in costumes and they'd be cooking or they'd be working in the fields. And so they had like a Norwegian homestead, they had a German homestead, they had a Yankee homestead, they had an African American homestead. So they have all these different buildings with people in them acting as they would in, say, 1850. So there was a German homestead, and in the German homestead there was a root cellar, and in that root cellar they had a crock pot, a covered crock pot with fermenting beer, being Germans in the 1850s. And I looked at that and it just fascinated me, and I thought, wow, I wonder what immigrants would have brewed when they came over from Europe. And they brought their tradition. What would they have made? Mm-hmm. And so it was at room temperature. Well, it was in a root cellar, so it was cool, but it was not lager beer. There's no way that someone would have made lager beer, particularly in the summertime. They would have made a simple ale. And I thought about what ingredients they would have used. Well, they maybe would have used a little bit of wheat. They would have used local malt. Maybe they would have used corn. Certainly was a lot of corn. There is a lot of corn in Wisconsin. Also, maybe if they were affluent, maybe they would have used hops from Czech Republic if they were able to get them. And so out of this, and they would have been unfiltered. So out of this, I came up with a beer. And it was 1850s, the pale lagers were becoming fashionable. So I'm going to make it a pale beer. And it was just sort of a fun experiment in trying to imagine what a farmer would have made. And I said, well, it's was brewed on a farm, it was inspired by a farmhouse, so I'm going to call it a farmhouse ale.
Yeah.
And most people were perfectly happy with that, but the pedantics, the haters, were like, well, you know, it's not a saison. I never said it was a saison. No, it's not a cream ale. I never said it was a cream ale.
Yeah.
It's our, what kind of beer is it? I don't know. It's our beer. It's New Glarus. It's a beer that I came up with. I don't know what it is. It's a beer. Most people, of course, were perfectly happy with that answer.
With that answer, yeah.
And, you know, the rest is history. Of course, another caveat is there's no more corn in that beer because our customers were very vocal that they did not like GMO corn. And mm-hmm. we could not find non-GMO corn because corn is GMO,
and
everything
is
commingled
now.
Together. I could get non-GMO corn, but it comes from China. And I said, yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's really non-GMO. So we now make it all malt.
Well, that's very interesting. And I'm glad you brought the cream ale, farmhouse ale kind of debate. Cause I've read that before, and it sounds like, you know, in your mind, when you're creating these things and, you know, it almost becomes sort of like stupefying to you that these debates sort of crop up of
yeah, definitely.
Like it's kind of sort of beyond the point, right?
Yeah, let's get a job.
and one thing I would like to point out is it seems like completely changing or completely removing an ingredient from a malt bill would be incredibly difficult and maintaining the flavor profile, right? Was that hard or?
We used only 10% of the grist was corn.
Yeah.
Corn, of course, corn grits contribute a much lower level of protein than malted barley. So that was the beginning of my search for low protein barley. So what I did was, so at that point, maybe it was being made with the typical barley malt, which is 12% protein. And so then I started to look for malt that was 10% protein mm-hmm. so that it would mimic, the starch from the malt is similar to the starch from corn, but without the since corn has no protein, I look for low protein barley. And so to this day, Spotted Cow is, we contract for the lowest protein, well, for somewhere between 10 and 11% protein.
Very, very cool. And, so thinking about sort of the way you process and the way you write a recipe, it's almost starting to sound like the style guide's way just outside the sort of frame of reference here for what you want to do.
I look at them, but I don't use them as gospel.
So if we're talking about another beer that's, you know, part of our, you know, core lineup in Moon Man, for example, Moon Man to me is one of my favorite just hoppier beers because the flavor is there. The hop presence is there, but it's not, you know, like in a West Coast pale ale where it's just going to kind of hit you with it over and over again until you take your next sip. To me, the time, and I might be ignorant to sort of the timeline of these things, but Moon Man seems to have come out at a time period that, if not as contemporaneous, almost sort of predates the session style.
It definitely
boom.
Did.
It definitely predated it.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So can you walk us through like how you're trying to come up with an IPA or an IPA like beer that's going to be a little bit different, that there isn't really a definition for what that is yet.
No. Where that totally 100% came from was from Russian River Brewing. Mm-hmm. So Deb and I are good friends with the owners of Russian River Brewing, Vinny and Natalie, and they are just the sweetest people. And Vinny is an absolute brilliant brewer. He is one of the best brewers in the world. And a lot of your listeners, of course, know Pliny the Elder. And Pliny the Elder,
it's a great beer.
You and I have drank our share of that beer, and it's a spectacular beer. And Deb is not an IPA drinker, but when she drinks Pliny, she says, "Wow, that's a really good beer." And so the problem is that a beer that, you know, anytime you have a double IPA, it's 6.5, 7, 8% alcohol. It's not something that you can drink in a session. I said, you know, I was really inspired by Pliny the Elder, but I wanted to make like a mini version of that, mm-hmm. a beer that I didn't use the word sessionable, but a more easy drinking, lower alcohol version of that beer. And so that's where I conjured the idea for a beer that was very hop aromatic, but not as high in alcohol as Pliny. So certainly I'm not saying that it's Pliny the Elder. I'm not saying that it's a copy of it, but I'm saying that the idea for Pliny the Elder inspired me to make Moon Man. And the problem is that when the beer police decided that this session beer was a thing, IPAs were a thing. There, I remember the big, the British, they're like really caustic to me. Sometimes I read their things on the internet, like, you guys need to chill out, because they get really angry about it's got to be less than 4% alcohol. And it's like, wow, you know, again, getting back to the idea of religion. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't even want to be involved in any of those discussions because they're just too much vitriol and anger. So it would not fit by the trolls would not fit it as a session beer, but it certainly, that was the intent.
Yeah.
And the reason they want is because it's 5% alcohol.
Yeah.
So, oh my God, horror of horrors. it doesn't fit to that category, but I don't care. I wasn't trying to fit into a category. I'm not brewing this style. It was an idea for a beer that was meant to be easy drinking, but aromatic.
Yeah. And I think, I think the end product, you know, sort of illustrates you hit that on the head.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the ones I just always have in my refrigerator, because it's a beer you can just open up and just drink and know, like, I mean, you know, I'm not committing to like, you know, a 16 ounce tall boy of this thing. Yeah. I know I'm going to be able to have my beer, maybe have two or three more and feel pretty okay about my night.
Sure. Well, you know, and the name of that beer, Deb thought of the name of that beer. We had a brewer that worked here, and he had a Tomcat named Moon Man.
Yeah.
And he used to come to work in the morning and say, you know, that Moon Man, he's just a cool cat, because he's a big tomcat, and he used to go out in the day and he'd walk around the neighborhood and he'd drop by to people's houses to say hello to the old, you know, old ladies in the neighborhood. And he was just very chill, and he would make his rounds and come home at night. And Jarrett used to say, you know, like, Moon Man, he's a cool cat. So unfortunately, Moon Man's gone now, God rest his soul, but Deb went to Jarrett and said, hey, would you mind if I named a beer after your cat? And Jared said, no, that's fine.
Would I mind? Jeez, that's
so she gave him a little can of paint and one of those little white Dixie plates. Mm-hmm. And she said, give me his paw print. So he went home and dipped poor Moon Man's paw in the paint and then pressed it like you would a fingerprinting on this Dixie plate. And then Deb traced it and made that the label. So when you see that label, that is literally Moon Man's paw print.
That's really cool. And we've talked a little bit about the iconography of the brewery here, of New Glarus. And I think as we're talking about just sort of innovating in the space of beer and all of that, I don't think it can be actually, overstated how sort of at the time innovative the labeling and the artwork was for beers like Moon Man and Spotted Cow, certainly. And, before that, the drawings on Belgian Red and that sort of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about how beer was marketed and sold when you guys first started? Because it was all, it seemed more like clean, right? Like more just like, here's the German name for the beer and here's, just a plain kind of label. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how the sort of tongue-in-cheek labeling and stuff started coming about? And
well,
because you see it everywhere now.
Yeah. Well, Deb, reversed six packs with the cardboard facing out. Mm-hmm. Deb was really the first one to do that. She wanted to print on the craft side of the cardboard, and the six pack manufacturers thought she was freaking nuts. And so that was her vision, because she kind of, again, like me with beer, she wants to go her own way. We met in 1983. So we've been together for almost 40 years, and I was brewmaster at a brewery in Montana, and she was doing marketing and graphics at that brewery. So ironically, we're kind of still doing the same things we were 40 years ago, and we're just kind of now starting to figure it out. But we were, the guy who owned the brewery that I worked for was a wine importer. So we were exposed to really good wine from a young age. So we looked at the labels. Deb, being into art and graphics, paid a lot of attention to the labels. Fritz Maytag at Anchor Brewery was way ahead of his time, and he had really nice textured wine quality paper on his labels. Yeah. And paid a little bit extra money for that and iconic bottle. And so those things kind of got Deb thinking about being unique and not being like every other beer. And it was and is difficult for her, because people will fight you, label manufacturers, or maybe the technology doesn't exist. Trying to put those heavy stock labels onto a wet beer bottle is mm-hmm. not so easy, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a lot of things that were difficult for us as we move forward in our business.
Yeah, and that'll make sense. And I think, pointing to, as you're pointing to little points of reference or points of inspiration, whether it's, out at Russian River or Anchor, these are things that are, people are working in this same space, and taking that point of inspiration, I think, is very important for a craftsperson and certainly an artist and a scientist, as sure. we've talked about collaboration.
Well, you asked about what was beer like in 1993. And so in Wisconsin, there was most taverns had three or four beers on tap, and it was always Miller Lite. Miller Lite was everywhere.
Yeah.
And then there was Amber, Sprecher Amber or Capital Amber. And so if you were a craft brewer, you made an amber lager, and that was hands down, that's what you did. So when we came to town and we did not make an amber lager, we specifically did not make an amber lager because Kirby made a spectacular one and Randy Sprecher made a spectacular one.
Yeah.
They both were great beers. And in fact, at one point, I believe they were both made at Sprecher Brewing Company, because Kirby's business outgrew his ability to make the beer, I believe. Mm-hmm. So an amber lager's already existed. So why would we be copy somebody else? But at that point, the wholesalers were a little bit taken aback by the idea of a craft brewery not making an amber lager. And in fact, I had one wholesaler say to me early in our business, craft brewers, they wouldn't know how to make an American-style lager. And I said, really? And I said, I personally made millions of barrels of it. I'm going to make one. And that's where Totally Naked came from. And Totally Naked used to be made with corn, but Deb said, no, 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 I want it to be all malt. So Totally Naked is an American style lager, but horror of horrors, it doesn't fit the style because it's 100% malt. So that came out of as me saying, watch me, I can do it. The first beer we made was called Edelpils, and that was a pale lager, and which also kind of threw people for a loop. They didn't know what to think of it. And it was difficult because a lot of people at that time, we'd say, you know, so we have this pale lager, blah, blah, blah. Oh, okay, well, that's nice, but I like German lager. Okay, but ours is fresh. It's local, local ingredients, local labor, keep money in the state, blah, blah. Uh-huh, I think I'll have a Planer. And so it was very difficult. Mm-hmm. But the idea for that beer came from when we had gone to Germany, and we ended up on our way to my job, we ended up in having to spend the night in Stuttgart. And in those days, there was no, you know, there was no Expedia, and there wasn't an internet, so you couldn't go, you know, search a hotel down. And so we got off at the main train station. And anybody who's traveled in Europe, and you get off in this city center in a main train station, it's somewhat disorientating. And it was late at night, and our two daughters were very, very young, and so we were jet lagged and tired and hungry, and we could not find a hotel. Everything was full.
Yeah.
And finally, we found a hotel in the seedier part of town, and they didn't have any room either. But by then it was like, I don't know, 9 o'clock at night, and the kids were tired. And the guy who was working at the desk felt really bad for us. And he more or less had like basically a closet. And he said, I'll put some blankets and pillows in there, and you know, you guys can stay there. So it was like, you know, for us, it was freaking Hilton.
Yeah.
So then I went out, and by that time, everything was closed as far as restaurants. I had to get some food. You know, there's no place to go. And as you know, in Germany, at least at that time, the only place that are open are like kebab shops and maybe an Italian pizza.
Oh, yeah. I never turned down a Donner.
Yeah, right. only the immigrants are working at weird hours. The Germans have long gone home. So I got a pizza and a couple of half-liter bottles of Budvar, mm-hmm. Budweiser from Czech Republic, not American Budweiser, but Czech Budweiser. And so I brought it back to our little closet of a hotel room, and we had pizza. Deb and I and the kids had pizza, and we shared two bottles of Budweiser Budvar. And Deb said, damn, this is good beer. This is, I mean, fresh Czech Budvar was just really, really good.
Yeah.
And so Deb said, you know, let's model Edelpils after Budvar. And so that was the inspiration for Edelpils. That started us out.
Yeah. And, you know, of course I was not around for the first brewing and bottling of Edelpils, but I believe it was the 20th anniversary, maybe it came out again.
We do it from time to time.
Yeah. And it's a really good beer.
Yeah, well, we're coming up on our 30th anniversary. So
there may be something like that.
Yeah, there may be something.
It was really funny. Kate and myself moved to New Glarus in 2013. So I believe that was the year it came out. And I never had like my own lawn in my adult life. And I just got done mowing the backyard, and she came home from the gas station here with, you know, two roast beef gas station sandwiches and two loose bottles of Edelpils.
Yeah.
And as we sat in the backyard on lawn chairs and,
there you go.
And drank Edelpils and ate sandwiches. So it's a very, very similar experience.
Yeah. That was your lawnmower beer.
Yeah. It was really, really good. We had and this is a different question than one I was talking about before, but we had a sort of weird question about beer labeling and how, you know, that sort of gets worked out, how you check if there is a beer that has that name. And, mm-hmm. You know, I know you basically have to check with the copyright office, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So one of the things...
Or you just have to do a search and see if the label exists. Because if the name exists... then it's not like Scream. We want Deb wanted to name the beer Screaming Eagle after the famous iconic eagle that was with the Civil War soldiers from Wisconsin.
Yeah,
but Screaming Eagle, you know, anybody who knows wine knows that Screaming Eagle's already taken.
So when we're talking about sort of being that thin. The thin end of the wedge as far as, you know, beer styles that later become sort of very popular, right? One of the things that struck me just as odd in looking up through all the labels and everything, and pastry stouts, coffee stouts, these things are very, you know, very popular now. Marrying chocolate with stout, coffee with stout, hazelnut with stout, all of these things are sort of have sort of blown up in the last, you know, 7 to 10 years or so. And it struck me just as particularly kind of awesome that Nuglaris' coffee stout is just called coffee stout. That's the copyrighted label. How early did you guys brew a coffee stout?
Oh God, I don't remember. It's been, it's 95 maybe? 95, I think, something like that.
So
97?
So how does that, like, you know, and you can see how, you know, a trend will crop up and then you see, okay, now boom, 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 these five or six people are now putting out that thing. So how does something like a coffee stout come about in 95 or 96 when you don't really have that roadmap to go by, I guess?
Well, at that point, I like stouts. I like, I like all kinds of stouts. We don't brew a lot of them, because there are already a lot of really good ones, but, I thought if we're going to make a stout, well, it should have a kind of a special twist on it. And I like coffee. Deb and I drink, French press coffee. We love good coffee, good, well-made coffee. So I thought, you know, that might be kind of a cool thing to put in the beer. So we did a cold steep of coffee and added it to the beer. But the funny thing is about that beer, we came out with coffee stout and we got label approval and we started making it. And the TTB, or at that time, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So we're the government agency that has to deal with tobacco, firearms, and beer. So that gives you an indication of what we're up against. They sent us a letter that said, you got to stop because coffee is not an approved ingredient in beer. It is now, but at that point, you can't use it in beer. So you got to take it out of your beer. So we had to change the recipe. It seems that they're kind of willy-nilly. They kind of changed their, so for a year or two, we changed the label and there was no coffee in it.
Yeah.
It was just made with dark malts that have, that mimic coffee. So then, a couple of years went by and the government in their, infinite wisdom sent us another letter and said, your label is deceptive because you call it coffee stout, but there's no coffee in it. So if you're going to make a beer that's called coffee stout, you have to add coffee. Okay, good idea. We'll do it.
We can certainly achieve that.
Yeah. So then we put it back in and, I don't argue with the government. I just say, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. And, that was that.
Yeah. You know what? You presented me with a very convincing argument and I will certainly add coffee to my beer.
Yeah. Like I've said before, when people talk about government conspiracy theories, I'm like, no,
they're not that together.
No, they're not that together.
Well, that to me is just, it's just amazing when you think about, you know, being that sort of early on something that, you know, they don't even have like a definition for it
That's
yet,
right.
or they don't even have
That's
the regulation
right.
for it yet. So, you know, when I was looking into that stuff, it just particularly struck me as like, you know, just evidentiary of like, yeah, you can almost be, you know, so ahead of the game, people think you're behind, right?
Yeah, exactly. 100%. Yeah. Sometimes the chattering class doesn't really get what you're doing, and you know it happens with music, and things have a tendency to take time to develop, to be appreciated.
So for me, I'm you know, I've been involved you know, around here for a little while, but I'm certainly not the most knowledgeable guy on beer history, what the awards are. But can you walk us through what the Carl Strauss Award for Beer Innovation is?
Well, Carl Strauss was a famous brewmaster. He was educated at Weinstephan before World War II. His family was forced out of Germany when the Nazis came into power because of his ethnicity. He was basically shown the door. And I think they were astute enough to get out relatively early. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, enough said on that. So he ended up coming to America, and I believe he ended up in Los Angeles, and he got a job with Pabst. Mm-hmm. And he worked his way up the ladder to basically be vice president in charge of brewing for Pabst. And he educated a whole group of American brewers. So there are a whole generation of people my age and older who were mentored by Carl Strauss. He was a great brewmaster, trained in traditional Germanic brewing, and he led Pabst to greatness. And he was a charitable man. Yeah, he had a bit of a temper if you screwed up. He didn't suffer fools, but he was incredibly generous. And when I worked for a company building breweries, JB Northwest out of Oregon, and Carl was had a consulting business after he retired from mm-hmm. Pabst. He built small breweries around the country, and our company supplied the equipment. So I did a lot of brewery startups with Carl. So I would be in charge. I was a project manager, so I built the breweries. I could weld at that time, and get the brewery set up, and then Carl would show up, and he would come with a recipe, and then whoever was going to be the brewmaster at this small brewery or brew pub or whatever would be there, and all three of us would spend a few days brewing. And so by that time, Carl was, you know, was pretty old. He was probably in his 70s and 80s, and but we were very close, and mm-hmm. he loved Deb. He just loved Deb to death. And so he would come around to the brewery, and he was very inspirational to us, because to have somebody like that wishing us well and believing in us was hugely, hugely motivating and helpful. But in any event, this is an award that's given every year to brewers that have, I guess you could say, brewers that have kind of tried to emulate, although I'm certainly can't hold a candle to Carl, but that try to emulate that charity of knowledge and innovation. And so, that was a kind of a big deal for me.
Very cool. Yeah. It sounds like it. Like, yeah, getting a sort of a little stamp of approval from someone you truly respect.
That's right.
I think it can't be overstated how buoying that can be for someone starting out, or someone sort of mid stride, I guess.
Right. Well, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm blessed that I'm of the generation that bridges the brewers that were pre-prohibition brewers. So I knew they were old men in their 80s and 90s, but I took classes at Siebel's, and I spoke to old brewers that were maybe apprentice before mm-hmm. prohibition. And so that generation I spoke to. And so that was interesting to me, you know, to speak to somebody and say, you know, back in your day when you were starting out, there was one or two breweries in every town, especially in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. There's breweries everywhere.
Yeah.
And I hear about how good the beer was. Was the beer good in those days? No, it wasn't good.
There was a lot of it.
Yeah, there was a lot of it, and it wasn't particularly good. But I guess my point is simply that these older generation was fun for me to learn from them, and also to understand that the things that they did 100 years ago or more were things that we're relearning, and we think that we're clever and we're figuring out all of these cool little things like dry hopping and whatever. They were doing it years ago. My mentor is Ludwig Narzis in Germany, and he said, oh yeah, we used to dry hop Kolsch beers and alt beers in Germany, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. Oh yeah, we dry hopped them. And I said, was that legal back then? And he says, I don't know, we never asked. Which is always a funny thing. He always told me another story. He was brewmaster at Löwenbräu in Munich, Löwenbräu in Munich. And he said, you know, he said, when you make a pale, a Helles Bock or a Blonde Bock, it's got to be it's got to be at least a 30 IBUs. And he says, our beer was less than that. And every year I kept raising it and until we got to 30 IBUs. And that was perfect. That was perfect because he loves hops.
Yeah.
And I say, well, what do the owners of the brewery say? He says, I don't know. I never asked them, which is typical Ludwig Nartz's humor.
But that's, you know, but that's the perfect sort of distillation of the point where we're sort of getting around here is, you know, there is a spirit in this business, and a spirit in amongst brewers of that sort of, you know, that sort of rebel attitude, like, I didn't bother to ask. And you know what? I didn't consult the style book. Yeah, I just made what I wanted to make.
Exactly. hence getting back to your original point. No, I didn't check the style book. I just brewed what I thought tasted good.
And speaking of the style book and speaking of how sort of, you know, beer is judged in this country, certainly, but around the world, you know, you enter beers into beer competitions and they have a million styles you can enter them into.
Sure.
So do you find that particularly difficult? And, you know, when you're trying to figure out where to enter a particular beer you want to, you know, enter to like the Great American Beer Festival or something like that?
Sure. No, I don't think about beer styles. In fact, beer competitions are funny because when you win a medal, it's like everything is great. When you don't win that competition's fixed. But no, I don't think about beer styles, and that's a problem when you're any, you know, like I read homebrew literature, and there's many articles about how to brew a beer to win a medal.
Yeah,
and that's not really how craft brewers think.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's a joke that the propensity to win medals is inversely proportional to that sales for the beer. It doesn't necessarily contribute to sales.
Yeah.
As a brewer, to win a medal is a win for one's ego. And it is eminently satisfying.
Oh yeah. I'm sure it feels really good.
And the medals that, or the beers that win, are to the T match the style. So it is, if you have a beer, if you're lucky enough to produce a beer to fit into a category, that's great. Spotted Cow, for example, doesn't fit into a category because a cream ale has to be clear, and they're not going to change that.
No.
There's not going to be a subcategory. Now a beer like Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, that category didn't exist for American style pale ales until Sierra Nevada came along, and now there's that style. And also with Widmer Hefeweiss, that American wheat beer didn't exist until they brewed that beer, and there was a few others out in Oregon and Washington that were in that style and developed the style. But unless you're lucky enough to catch the attention of the Association of Brewers that they come up with a category, you basically can't put it in because it could be the greatest beer in the world, but if it's not to style, then it doesn't win. I remember I was judging at the Great American Beer Festival, and I was judging the German Pilsner category, and I tasted a beer, and it was like the best Pilsner I think I've ever had in my life. I mean, you know, I've said that before, but it was spectacular. And I said, this is Head and Shoulders, the best beer on the table by far. This is a gold medal beer. This is a beer that I would drink every day.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's why I like, there's a competition in England, and their direction to the judges are, if this beer was in your local, would you drink it every day? And that to me is a good competition. It's not about styles. It says it's got to be between 4 and 5% alcohol. And would you drink this beer? That to me is a good competition.
Yeah.
But in this, the Association of Brewer competition, it's, does it fit these guidelines? And the captain of the table said, no, that's not a German Pils, that's a Bohemian Pils. And I said, come on. I said, this beer is spectacular. Look, Dan, if we're going to pick this beer to be a medal, we're going to send a message to all brewers that you can enter the wrong beer in a competition and win a medal. Oh, in a category and win a medal. So everybody voted against it except for me. And I, and they never tell you what beer, they don't ever tell you the names of the beer. So you never know who it was, but somewhere out there in the world, if you're a brewer listening to this and you entered a Bohemian style beer in the German Pils category and you did not win a medal, your beer was spectacular.
Your beer was really good.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you have won your fair share of Great American Beer Fest medals.
Sure.
You know, Blacktop and Very Sour, Blackberry, recent notables.
A lot for Staghorn, too.
Yeah, actually. Staghorn.
Totally Naked, but yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really cool. I didn't really, it's really funny when I walk past that the case, just how many there are in there.
Which is funny, when Totally Naked won a medal, a very good friend of mine is brewmaster at Anheuser-Busch. And so, you know, back then, it was always Bud Miller and Coors that were always winning the medals. And it was before really craft brewers. Now craft brewers all win that American Pilsner category. But we won a medal, and I kind of was teasing my buddy from Anheuser-Busch, which I don't think he appreciated.
Well, that's the good kind of teasing. It comes from a spot of love.
Yeah, exactly. We'll go with that.
Yeah. So yeah, we're hitting about our time, but we did have a question from a couple episodes ago that a listener wrote in with that I thought was particularly interesting, because I sort of it sort of piqued my ears up when I heard it. And this came from a guy named Cameron, and he said, I believe we were talking wheat beer, and we were talking about Weizenbach, and you said you lobbied heavily for the brewing of Weizenbach. And so his question was, Dan has to lobby for beer? Is there a democratic process for how beer should? You would think Dan Carey would just be able to say, I'm putting my hand on the table and decreeing we are brewing a Weizenbach today.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through how that works a little bit?
I always say that I'm just a simple village brewer. But no, it's very much Deb will say that if you can't sell a beer, you're just a glorified home brewer. So you have to make a beer that you'll be able to sell.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I mean, we brew a beer in batches of 100 barrels each. So that's a lot of beer. Mm-hmm. So the choice of what beers that we brew are made by more or less by committee. And Deb is the final decider. Deb's the president of the brewery. And by the way, the reason we've been successfully married for 40 years is complete division of labor. In other words, Deb doesn't argue with me about what hops and malts I buy and what temperatures I ferment at. But when it comes to label design, names of beers and beer styles to brew, she's the final decider. So it is very much a democratic process. Once a year, we sit down, or twice a year, we sit down with people from our sales department, Deb, and people from production, myself and a few other people, and we kick around ideas, and we look at what beers are sold in the previous years, what beers people are asking for, what fits into the brand calendar, and maybe there'll be at one point Deb will say, okay, in this winter section, I'm thinking we should make a strong dark beer. Are there any ideas? Does anybody have any ideas? Well, how about a barley wine? No. How about a Doppelbock? Yeah, let's make a Doppelbock. Okay, then next year, how about we make a Weizen Doppelbock? Well, I don't know. Let me think about that. Okay, we'll do that. So it is it always is a group decision, with Deb being the final decider. But every year I always ask for a Pilsner.
Yeah, she had mentioned you are on a never-ending quest for the perfect Pilsner.
I am. That's my life's work.
That's good. That is your white whale.
Yes, right.
So what happens when you get it?
Yeah. That'll never happen.
Okay.
Perfection is never achieved.
Gotcha. Well, it's good to set a goal on an intangible, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
So that way you can always be innovating, always be pushing that ball forward.
Yeah.
Well, as always, it was great chatting with you, Dan.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate the opportunity
to do
this.
Thank you, and congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you very much. If you're into esoteric literary fiction, hit me up in, you know, a
year
or so.
What's the name? Tell us the title.
Oh, it's called Awful People.
Awful People.
A ghost story.
Yeah. Well, your writing is always a little bit... edgy humor, so dark humor. So I look forward to reading it.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate it.
Thanks.